Seattle police got in trouble for using excessive force. Nationwide, you know the debate over why police keep shooting men of color. Now, a former Seattle police chief is proposing solutions. Norm Stamper was chief of police here for 6 years in the 90s. His book is called To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. And we started out by talking about who becomes a cop. Stamper told me how he himself first got into policing with the best of intentions, but he was quickly changed by the culture.
Well, if I can use myself as an example, I became a cop with vaguely idealistic notions. I'm here to protect and serve. I'm here to help my fellow citizens. I'm not going to use the N-word. I'm not going to engage in unfair, unjust practices. In other words, I'm going to be a good cop who's behaving properly. And within a breathtakingly short period of time, my views about police work changed as a consequence of my association with police officers who'd been there for years.
What did police officers who'd been there for years tell you that changed you into a sometimes bad cop?
Well, the first and probably most important thing, and this is such a cliche in police circles, is that they told me to forget everything I learned in the academy. That's ivory tower stuff. That's probably coming right out of the chief's office, and you know how they are. And so if you're going to be a real cop, follow my lead. Racism, sexism, homophobia, all were very real for me in the ancient days of my rookie days as a police officer.
Real for you in your heart or the cops around you?
First of all, the cops around me were magnetic. They were humorous. I felt for the first time in my life I had a real family. Not to get too personal here, I came from an abusive home. My father was quite brutal. And in addition to physical abuse, he heaped a lot of emotional abuse as well. You're no good, you don't belong, so on and so forth. Then I become a cop and suddenly I belong. And that's powerful stuff.
So it's family, it's belonging, but what does that have to do with being abusive to other people?
That's a really good question. And, you know, I've done my level best to sort it out. Why would I transform myself from somebody who wanted to treat people with dignity and respect to someone who 5 minutes into the job is abusing the people he's been hired to protect and serve? So for me, the short answer is I liked what I saw among my fellow officers. I was drawn to it. That's not something that, you know, that most people would like to confess. But it was not very long before my badge grew heavy on my chest and the power went right to my head. I'd never had power in my life. Suddenly, I've got a lot of it.
Okay. Power, that's alluring.
It's pivotal.
We all know. Another element you talk about is fear.
Yes.
How afraid are police officers?
Some police officers are afraid, know they're afraid, and manage their fear. Those are the officers you want patrolling your beat, showing up at your home. Some officers are afraid and don't know it, and that's a lot of police officers. It may still be a minority, but it's a significant number of police officers who are driven by fear, which causes them to behave impulsively. Oftentimes what looks like anger, certainly presents as anger, is in fact fear. And when you hear a police officer screaming on, for example, one of these videotapes that we will see.
You mean the officer screaming at Mr. Castile, who he just killed?
Absolutely. That is one, I think, poignant and excellent example. Fear causes our perception to distort. And when that happens, we see threats that aren't there. We may miss a threat that is there. And so fear, no matter how you slice it, needs to be understood by every single officer in this country and managed by every officer.
Power, fear, those are two of the most important forces I can think of. How could we possibly take power and fear out of being police officers? You have a gun, you have camaraderie, you are put in scary situations.
And the short answer is we can't eliminate it. What we can do is provide quality instruction of the type generally that we're not providing today that will allow police officers to experience what their bodies go through when they're scared. Put them in a situation, 3 o'clock in the morning, darkened alley, they see a figure down at the other end of the alley, somebody taking out the garbage or a hot prowler, and let them feel what it's like for their blood pressure to rise, for their vision to narrow and become tunnel-like. let them experience the gift that is feedback from their own bodies. And let them experience it not just once and say, okay, we've done our session on fear, the physiology of fear. Let them experience that in a structured and safe environment that can be debriefed following those simulations throughout their careers.
But you have described how that's the kind of thing that cops tell each other, yeah, we had to sit in the training, but we're the warriors. Now we're going to do it the way it actually needs to be done. Which, doesn't that put some of the onus on the citizens? Because we treat police like mythologized warriors. We seem to want them to be that.
Well, I think you've raised for me a terribly important question, and that is, for whom do the police work? The police in America, in this country, belong to the people, not the other way around. If we engender an attitude among police officers that, hey, we're the cops and you're not, if we foster feelings of superiority or supremacy on the part of police officers, we've done exactly the wrong thing. Now, the culture will do that, has the power to do that. Citizens have far more power than they really believe they have when it comes to local policing. And I'm a very strong advocate of what I would call true community policing, not some cosmetic or PR version of it.
But, for example, citizens don't tell our warriors, our military, how to do their unfathomable jobs. How can we be grateful without glorifying and warifying our police?
First, let's do understand that military warriors are just that. They are trained to kill. They are trained to follow orders. Police officers are trained to make decisions, life and death decisions, peace and freedom decisions, crucial decisions that affect people's lives, including their own, in some cases, for the rest of their lives. And so if we can recognize and appreciate that cops make decisions for a living and soldiers follow orders for a living, we can begin to build a different kind of a relationship, because that decision making in a free and democratic society needs to be shared. It cannot be any longer unilateral, arbitrary decisions on the part of the police about what we're going to do in the area of crime prevention or stop and frisk practices or search and seizure and the like. And the community has a stake. It could be argued they have the biggest stake in those decisions.
So what would I'm listening to you now on the radio. I'm a community member. What's my role in this?
Get to know your neighbor to the left, to the right, and across the street. Talk about, if it's important to you, talk about police policies and police practices. Talk about your experiences or the experiences of family or friends. And organize and mobilize and say, if the police department does not invite you in to the decision-making, the policy-making process, then insist on that invitation. Insist on your voice being heard. That is what a free and democratic society is all about. And in the end, it will benefit tremendously police officers. When they treat the citizens as their partners, when they share information, they get information. It's called the rule of reciprocity. You're nice to me, I'm likely to be nice to you. If you give me information, I'll probably give you information. That's how human nature kind of works.
So we can't just complain, huh? We have to take some responsibility here.
I think, by definition, a hollow complaint is just that. If you're just complaining to hear yourself kvetch about something, that's not going to be helpful to the process. If what you're identifying is a systemic problem or a behavioral problem on the part of an individual officer, you may, by lodging that complaint, save that cop his or her job.
How much can all of this citizen responsibility defeat that culture we talked about in the beginning? We have power, fear, racism, psychological issues that you had, that human beings have, that police have. What are the odds we can change those interactions?
I stumbled upon a Nelson Mandela quote recently, who, when he was told very early in his political agitation and organization and the like, this is impossible. This is utterly impossible. Do you know how deep the roots of apartheid go in this country? Do you realize how foolish is your dream? And he said, so it was impossible until it happened. And I'm absolutely convinced that people of goodwill, those in blue and those they are serving, working together can find common ground. There will always be unique idiosyncratic aspects of a workplace culture. I dare say you probably have those aspects here at KUOW. Everyone who's part of a workplace culture and grows up in that culture is going to have several, oftentimes competing views about, you know, what's right and what's wrong and how most effectively to get the job done.
We've been talking about American police culture. What's your take? I know you're out of Seattle, have been out a while, but you live in the area, you follow this. What's your take on policing that's happening in Seattle?
Well, to be clear, I have been gone for 15 years. That doesn't mean that my heart isn't still there. It doesn't mean that I don't have friends and former colleagues certainly still there. And it doesn't mean that I don't read the paper and listen to the radio. What I am seeing is improvement, incremental improvement in policies and practices. Seattle has been singled out by a lot of agencies around the country for its de-escalation training. If there is a skill more important than that one to a cop, I don't know what it is. Every situation you face could see escalation of tension, escalation of violence. And so if you recognize that whether it's a traffic stop or a missing juvenile or a barroom brawl, you have some skills that will allow you to help de-escalate that situation, that's powerful stuff.
Do you believe the Seattle Police Department is changing its culture?
I believe that no police department anywhere in this country is in any immediate danger of changing its culture. The culture does not change until the structure changes. If I belong to a paramilitary bureaucratic organization that believes in top-down command and control decision-making, that believes in rigid rulemaking and rule enforcement when discretion might be a wiser choice, if I'm part of an insulated, isolated culture that has engendered a really strong, intransigent in-group solidarity, that ain't going to happen by Tuesday, this cultural change. That is something that takes years. It is something that if we choose to confront, it is certainly malleable and can be changed. But I think we have to look at the structure. We have to look at what the drug war since 1971 has done to transform cops in this country. You don't fight a war without an enemy. You don't fight a war without soldiers. Well, guess what we did? When Richard Nixon famously proclaimed drugs public enemy number one and declared all that war on them, America's cops went to war with young people, poor people, and people of color. It's time to end it. It's time to end prohibition and replace that model with a regulatory model. Public health, not criminal justice. Treatment for those who are addicted, not jail. I mean, my God, we recognize that alcoholism is an illness. We should be recognizing that somebody who is addicted to any drugs is, in fact, an ill person and needs treatment, not bars.
I hate to be jaded, Norm, but I'm picturing you going in and having this talk in a precinct office in Baltimore or inner Chicago. I mean, aren't you an Orcas Island hippie? I mean, aren't you taking values from a place where it's easy?
Well, first, I've been called worse.
You know what I'm saying, though. Talking about culture here.
Yeah, I think the question is for police executives, for mayors, for other civic officials, for community activists, for anybody who perceives a need for change to learn how to treat people we disagree with that same dignity and respect we're asking of them. I think it's a leadership challenge for everyone who cares, regardless of position, official or otherwise. And I also think it requires schooling ourselves. Are there effective ways to communicate with people who disagree with us? Are there effective ways to influence the very people that we most want to influence? Or are we destined to just alienate them and give them all the ammunition they need to call us ivory tower characters or arbitrary and capricious administrators, that sort of thing? Labels don't help, but they're so common.
Sorry about the Orcas Island hippie label. I had to say it.
I'll wear it as a badge of honor.
Norm Stamper, wearing that badge. His book is To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police.